check out this episode. Dr. Kara Pepper is a practicing primary care internist and executive coach in Atlanta, Georgia. After 14 years in private practice, Dr. Pepper built her own 18-state telemedicine practice for adults across the Southeast, especially those with eating disorders. In addition to her clinical practice, she provides executive coaching and is the founder of Micropractice Mastermind, a community for physicians transforming healthcare through solo practice. Dr. Pepper is the podcast host of It's Not Just You. But first, a word from our sponsors. Hey there, it's Brad. As someone who's passionate about podcasting, I've always thought there should be more support for physicians who want to share their stories and expertise. That's why we're launching Dr. Podcast Network.
We're bringing together a community of physician podcasters with one goal in mind: to provide the tools, connections, and resources you need to grow your show. So whether you've been podcasting for a while or maybe you're just starting, we've designed this network to support you every step of the way, and we're going to help each other rise, not compete.
If this sounds like something you benefit from, we'd love for you to join us as we get closer to launch. So you can sign up at drpodcastnetwork.co for early access. Stay tuned for more details in the coming weeks. Really looking forward to what we can create together. Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. So let's get right into it. We're going to be talking about striking out on your own and starting your own practice, right? You coach people on this.
I do.
So
yeah.
What are some of the qualities that you've seen that are necessary in someone that's starting their own practice? Meaning, if you're someone who's on the fence about whether or not they should do this, who should and who shouldn't consider
this?
That's
right. Great question to just dive right in. I will say that any physician can start their own practice. I think that one of the biggest limitations that we have is that we think that it's like some other magical skill set that these magical business people seem to possess, and all we do is know how to practice medicine, and therefore we are not qualified. Listen, we get babies out of people's uteruses within 2 minutes. We manage complex medical illness. We, you know, do organ transplants. If you can do that, you could start a business. Now, the real question is, do you want to start a business? I would not say that having my own solo practice, and I'm now entering my fourth year of it, is easier than being an employed physician, but it's the version of hard that I choose on my own terms. And I am really grateful for people who are worker bees who want to just come in and do their job as an employed physician and go home. But for the people like me who feel suffocated, who love innovation, who value autonomy, who really want to be in charge of their destiny, those people are really designed well for solo practice. It is exactly who we are as physicians. It's lifelong learning. It's showing up and trying to get a little bit better every day at what you're doing. It's being able to try and fail and not make that mean anything about you. So if you're a perfectionist and would really like to get over your perfectionism, open a business. It will definitely give you opportunities to do that. So for people who want to really reclaim healthcare and to do it in the way that means they're aligned with what they really value, those are the people it's designed for.
I totally get that. Because even though I am a worker bee in my practice, I do some things that help the practice run, but we're a practice of 170 partners, 250 physicians. Like, we've got plenty of people to run the show. I am not by any means running the show. I do a little help here and there. But outside the practice, I've got the podcast. I've got Dr. Podcast Network. I do expert witness work. And so, like, for instance, I'll be at my son's swim practice and my head will be in my laptop the whole time. Not as competitions, I'm 100% present, but for the practices. And I've had a couple of parents come up to me and say, do you work for yourself? Like, what is it that you do that you are always on your laptop? And if I didn't have those other responsibilities, I wouldn't be doing that. I would have so much more free time. But I do those things because I need that level of professional fulfillment. And I think
Yes. We
can kind of stagnate and we just kind of clock in and clock out. And I think it's a great way to slow down time, right? Because you have to be present so much more, learning new things. If you're in a rut, it's one of the many ways to get out of a rut. But You know, I think it's, you know, we talk about on the show being the best version of yourself. And it sounds like a great way to go about doing it, like reinventing yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I was an employed physician by a big hospital practice for 14 years. And I wouldn't have used the word bored because I certainly was busy. But in retrospect, I just felt, I like that word stagnation. Every 2 years, I was trying to kind of reinvent my practice, change my hours, change my clinical focus, leaned in and got new skills. But ultimately, I know in my core values, at the top of that list is autonomy. And I was feeling increasingly like I could be delivering care in a different way. And I wanted to do it differently. And I was in a practice that couldn't even tolerate beta testing. It was all or nothing. And for those of us, I think, who still really love practicing medicine, if you want that level of autonomy, there's a level of risk. You ask who can tolerate this. There has to be a little bit of a risk-taking adventure person in you to say, you know what, I'm going to give it a go. And when I really looked at what is the worst case scenario, let's say I leave my job that was wildly successful. I had a year's wait of patients to get in to see me. I'm going to leave this job. I'm going to set out on my own in a climate that less and less people are doing solo practice. What's the worst thing that can happen? And if the worst thing that could happen to me is that I went back to my old job or got a new job as a primary care doc, like that was what I was doing before. Like my reality was the worst case scenario. So it really wasn't that bad. And I was willing to take that risk. So I'm really glad I did.
Yeah. I mean, if you're leaving a job in a saturated market where you won't be able to get another job, like we're physicians, we're high in demand. That's an excellent way to put it. The worst case scenario is you just get another similar job to what you had before, right? That takes a lot of the anxiety away from it when you put it like that.
Yes, that's right. Our brains are designed to keep us safe. They're always scanning the horizon. We do this in the exam room every day. You know, we're always looking around the corner. What's the next three steps ahead of what our patients are going to need? And so that works very well as a clinical skill. But in life, you know, often the discomfort that we know, the burnout, the toxic workplaces, the frustration of, you know, insurance and prior authorizations, all that stuff, that pain that we know is more familiar than the uncertainty of change. And so often we just say, well, that just feels so big and scary. I'm just going to stay here and be miserable. And there's probably many reasons that I left. But in the end, I was having this moment in an after hours meeting with our practice during COVID, where we're again looking at how to put smoking cessation in the chart for the 500th time. And I said to myself, I just can't do this anymore. And I could be dead next week because of this pandemic. And I know in my bones that I would regret not betting on myself. And I know that I can show up for myself. So let's just go for it. So,
although the smoking cessation thing, that's MIPS, right? That's not your practice's fault. That's how Medicare determines if you're giving valuable, value-based care. Right. And so it's got to end up in the chart and it's got to end up in a specific way and it's got to be a click box and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, we can't always blame our practices for that stuff. That's Medicare and their billing, how they figure
out
that
is true. Well, I will say that this particular week, as before we started recording, I told you that I'd just gone back from vacation and now I'm doing that drinking through the fire hose of what happens or can happen when you come back from vacation. What I did right before you and I met was to sit down with yet again another tech company to say, what are all the ways that I can optimize systems in my practice that work specifically for me? And so looking at AI automations for how to put MIPS in so that I don't have to be the one to sit and have a practice meeting to say, hey, guys, let's make sure we're putting it in the right place. It just gets taken care of. And that for me, that beta testing has been really, really empowering to be like, let me just try to do this differently. And in terms of sustainability in this market, using tech, using the new advances, being able to try things that work, it really is going to be the thing that keeps these smaller practices afloat so that they can decrease their overhead and really just focus on taking care of patients.
Well, you mentioned smaller practice. You also mentioned doing it on your own terms. And this is something that we hear a lot from people that leave corporate medicine to go out on their own is they want to be able to practice it on their own terms. They don't like that the visits are so short and they're driven by the economics of the healthcare company. But that being said, you still need to pay to keep the lights on. You still need to pay your employees. You still need to pay yourself. You need to pay for all this technology. And the way that you do that is by seeing patients, right?
That's right.
And these bigger practices have the advantages of leverage with insurance companies. So they get paid more per visit, per CPT code than an individual practitioner. They have leverage, right? They also have economies of scale. And so they're able to negotiate more with a technology company in order to get the latest and greatest technology for their practice. It might not be geared towards you as an individual, but you know, in theory, it is optimized for their physicians or for the practice or for their billing, whatever, right? So you don't have those economies of scale. You don't have that leverage in an individual practice. And it's so time consuming to manage your practice. Like you said, you've got to do everything. And so where does this extra time with patients come from? It seems like it's getting eaten up by all these other things.
Yeah, I think if we're trying to practice in the same way that a practice at scale is practicing, I think you have to just wipe the slate clean and redesign the practice from the ground up. There's a whole industry of people who are supporting physicians who are in solo or micro practices. And I think we've all seen that graph that looks at total cost of healthcare over the past 50 years, and physician salaries have that very low line at the bottom. It's very slowly increasing. But and then there's this mountain of administrative cost that overlies that. And when you look at, okay, great, Medicare reimbursement is not awesome, especially if you're not negotiating. How can you join professional networks through hospital systems to use their negotiated rates with insurance companies? How can you form networks of specialists that are able to navigate with employers? The Direct Primary Care Network is doing this all the time to say, hey, we've got this huge network of people. We would love to be able to serve you and cut insurance out of the middle. And so how do you look at the systems when you don't have to support these massive overheads that can use tech and automate things? I mean, I'm an N of one, and I finally hired a virtual assistant about 6 months ago, which was 2.5 years into this practice. Using automation required me to have no one to help answer the phones and do all of these things. And for patients who want someone to pick up the phone, maybe I'm not the right doctor for them, but I will hear every day in my clinic that patients say, I'm so grateful. I just schedule at 11 p.m. because everything's automated through your website. And I think when we try to do what's always been done, yes, these small practices are going to fail. But when you look at it with new eyes and say, how can we do this and be lean and nimble, it really does open the floodgates to a lot of possibility that bigger practices actually can't navigate quite as much.
That's interesting because I hear complaints from my patients because we have call centers that answer the phone because mm-hmm. you can hire many more people in overseas mm-hmm. than you can hire in the States, you know, per person. So calls get answered so much faster, right? They get mm-hmm. answered so much faster, but they're being answered by someone overseas and not in the office. And they lament the days of the mom and pop shops where, you know, of the solo practitioner where you knew the person that was answering the phone. And what you're saying is we don't even have someone answering the phone. I'm a solo practitioner. I don't even have someone answering the phone. So those days are gone for everybody, really.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly could hire that. And I think ultimately it comes down to like, what is your practice model? And it is much, much cheaper. So many people are hiring virtual teams overseas to decrease on this overhead so that they can have those services. And then you're seeing people go to cash-based models and build things within that model that may allow that. And ultimately, it gives the clients, our patients, more choice. Like if you are a Medicaid patient who cannot afford your $10 copay, that is a different model of care that is going to be delivered. But when you allow people to look at all the different models that are out there, and I'm not just talking about concierge medicine, because many people don't even want concierge medicine. You're just looking for how can I recreate the doctor-patient relationship and what are the key features that I need in practice? And I think everyone, both patients and physicians, are saying, I just want more time in person with the person in front of me to have that relationship. So offloading the administrative stuff is a really amazing way to do that.
Got it. Okay. So we're cutting the fat of the administrative burden and really some of the other personnel. In most practices, it's like 4 or 5 to 1 in terms of personnel for physicians. So you're saying you cut a lot of that out through automation, which is what, so you cut down on the overhead and then you're reclaiming a lot of that reimbursement.
Exactly right. Both in time and in compensation. That's exactly right.
Amazing. So this wasn't on my list of questions that I sent you ahead of time, but you opened that door. So I'm wondering now, what are some of the more creative models that you've seen, right? We've done episodes on direct primary care. So that's direct primary care is where you have like kind of a subscription model, but and you don't go through insurance. So it's a monthly fee or an annual fee to have access to the doctor. And the doctor will either see you in person or telemedicine, some combination of the both. And then you can attempt to get medications and imaging and such through insurance, but the doctor-patient relationship is not managed through insurance. So that we've had episodes on. But what are some of the other, you know, more creative models that you've seen?
Yeah. So there's obviously concierge medicine, which is the double dipper, right? So you to buy out the physician's time with a retainer fee. And then they also bill through insurance. There's DPC that's totally off the grid. You pay a subscription fee. And they can write for imaging and lab services, et cetera, through insurance. But cutting insurance out entirely and going directly to the radiology facility or directly to the lab, like LabCorp or Quest, there are cash pay models, which, I mean, literally a CBC is $4. And I just personally got some routine blood work done that happened to not get billed through insurance. And my CBC was $87. Like, how is there this big gap? It's because they're trying to get this money from the insurance companies. So going outside and paying cash, even if you have insurance, is often much cheaper than that. My model is kind of a one-off, which is literally the old school way of practicing medicine. Patients pay as you go. There is no retainer fee. There's no subscription. You just pay me for the visit, which we're starting to see more and more of, these like one-off visits. And then certainly telemedicine.
Is that irrespective of complexity, right? So I might bill a 99212 and I might bill a 99204, right? Which are dramatically different payments based on, you know, if I'm just taking out someone's earwax, actually that's not the code that I would bill, but, you know, versus someone who comes with dizziness and nosebleeds and sinus problems and, you know, a neck mass and, right? So how are you managing billing for the differences in complexity?
They literally just pay me for my time. Okay, that is it. Because I know that my brain, that's right. My brain is going to show up and do the work. And what I've had to recognize, which I think our insurance models really do not fully acknowledge, we should be compensated for very complex care that we deliver. In my world of internal medicine, complex multi-system disease feels a lot more complicated than just a regular blood pressure check. But from a patient standpoint, they value healing in a way that we undervalue that. Like, I may be like, oh, it's just a blood pressure check, no big deal. But they're bringing their anxiety, their worry, their bias, their trauma, all of that into the room. And that does not happen in a 2-minute visit. And so they are paying for me to show up in a healing space, even if I kind of undervalue that. So the time is the equalizer for me.
You spent years learning how to save lives, but no one taught you how to secure your own. When you work one-on-one with a CFP professional financial coach, you get a blueprint tailored for the long game of your complex situation. At My Financial Coach, they help physicians choose the best strategy to optimize your annuities and investments, implement tax-saving strategies, and tackle debt like your student loans or mortgage while refining your path to retirement. Save up for that boat, a child's college or wedding, or even a vacation home. Plan ahead for the impacts of the unexpected and understand how much life insurance you actually need. Project how getting married, raising children, or taking care of an aging parent affects the progress towards your goals. Advice-only financial planning through a fixed monthly subscription, not commissions, to keep planning unbiased and in your best interest. A financial plan isn't just about your money, it's about your future. Visit myfinancialcoach.com/physicians guide to doctoring to meet with a financial coach and find out if concierge financial planning is right for you. Again, myfinancialcoach.com/physicians guide to doctoring. Because a lot of what I talk about on this show are communication strategies for managing time. The goal is to have the patient leave being an evangelist, being like, oh my God, that was amazing, but also leave in a timely manner. So both of those, but the cognitive energy that's required, like it's tiring. By the end of the day, if I've been like using all of my strategies on all of my patients and, you know, they're having great experiences, but for me, it's really cognitively exhausting. So to be able to just say like, listen, we got all the time you need. I'm on your schedule. Take all the time you want. Although I wonder, are patients, since they're paying by the increment, right? What's the increment? 5 minutes, 15 minutes?
15, 30, and 60 for me.
Okay.
Yeah, so and a they new book patient that ahead of time. An hour.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so after that certain amount of time, you're like, ding, time's up.
Yeah, so I ask them. So with every new patient, I tell them, I recognize that most people who come to me are really frustrated with our healthcare system. Nearly 100% of my patients have experienced trauma in our healthcare system. And so my job is to be here in support of you. We can spend this time however you want. Some people are here just to make sure I'm not a sociopath, and other people have a problem that they want to solve. how would you like to spend our time today? I ask them point blank. And then I say, what do you want to get out of this visit? When you walk away today, what is the thing that you're going to be able to tell your family members? And for me, if they're like, hey, I've got, you know, this notebook full of records, I'm like, great, let's get into it. And if they're just like, I just, you know, it's one of the many ways we can signal to our patients, I see you, I hear you, and I'm here to serve you. Yeah. And they may need an hour for their blood pressure. I have a patient that every time I see them, they schedule an hour, and all I'm doing is checking their blood pressure.
But they're
that's
paying
what
for that
they
hour.
Actually need.
Yeah. I wonder if they utilize the time differently, knowing that they're paying for the time, right? Are they talking to you differently, managing themselves differently, communicating differently, knowing that they're paying by hour than they would for another physician where, you know, it's, what is that, Parkinson's law, where a meeting fills the space that it's given.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's true. But what we do not have capacity for in our current system that is so RVU generated is the real human experience of who these people are when they show up. Some people are just nuts and bolts. For me, when I go to the doctor, I don't need like a whole, you know, conversation in the beginning. I'm like, I'm here for a purpose. Please check my blood pressure, for example. But I have a lot of patients who need a chance to settle. They've had so much trauma. They're so nervous showing up at the doctor. It was all they could do to get in the door. By the time their nervous system has settled down so they can actually get out of fight or flight mode and ask the real questions that they have, you know, 15 minutes is gone and they historically are not getting their questions answered. So an hour long visit is not for everyone, but for some people, it's what they need for a variety of reasons. So to have a system that allows for that is pretty empowering. It feels really good for me.
So you also coach people on how to start a practice, right? And how to manage a micro practice. Actually, what's the difference between a micro practice and a solo practice?
I think probably an N of one physician, right? So a micro practice is just this idea that it can be a lean, nimble, small practice. And that may be two doctors, three doctors, whatever, but it's not a conglomerate. There's probably some threshold. It's the difference between several and a few.
Okay.
A solo practice is obviously one. A micro practice is probably a couple. And then anything beyond that starts to have economy of scale problems. So it's really, how can you make it as nimble without the extra employees that are really needed? That's how I think of a micro practice.
When you coach people on this, what have you found to be the difference between primary care and specialty care and procedure-based care?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. I find that that really is the delineator. So understandably, if you're a neurosurgeon, having an N of one with no support and being able to purely run a practice in the outpatient setting is probably not realistic, right?
Nope. We've had an episode on that with Brian Gantwerker. If you're interested, he's a spine surgeon out in California. Check out the episode that was about a year ago. So yeah, he started his own practice. So we had an episode with him. He's a spine surgeon. So it's possible. Back to what you're saying.
I love that you proved me wrong because I'm looking for these examples. But the reality is if you are someone who is operating, you know, let's talk about like a head and neck cancer surgeon, like that's not something that many people are going to cash pay for, right? So you need to be able to navigate in the insurance space. You need to have hospital privileges. And so that's a different set of problems to solve. You asked about novel practice models earlier. There are some people who will still say, I'm going to have a cash-based physician fee so that I'm not rushed through this complex visit, but I will have a separate LLC that bills everything through insurance. So I'll do your consultation. We'll take an hour if that's what you want. You're paying for my time, but I'll send everything else through insurance. And then certainly we're seeing people, there's a John Russell, who's a thyroid surgeon up in Baltimore. He was on my podcast recently, and he's, you know, doing complex thyroid cases and saying, I don't want to deal with insurance at all. So I've navigated, how do I do these cases for a cash pay basis? And he's actually finding that for many patients, it's cheaper to see him and pay cash as a surgeon than it is to actually go through insurance for many of his folks. So this kind of binary of, oh, it's too expensive to pay cash, I think we're finding is just simply not true because of the insurance markups. And I would say
for the doctor, but like for the patient, right, there's going to be a surgical fee, there's going to be a facility fee, there's going to be the pathologist, right? But from the practitioner's standpoint, that's really interesting because I would have thought dramatically differently, right? Because when you're talking, this is how much surgery is going to cost and you're just paying for the surgeon, you would want to go through insurance because that's kind of what insurance is for these type of like catastrophic events where you're having something like surgery, not having something like getting your blood pressure checked, right?
Yeah, but I think all of my proceduralist/surgical colleagues I've heard bemoan saying, you know, the patient is charged, I'm picking arbitrary numbers, like, you know, $1,000 for this colonoscopy, so to speak, but what I'm actually getting compensated is such a small fraction of that. And so meeting patients in the middle to say, hey, look, I know you're going to get billed $1,000 from your insurance company. Instead of me making only, I don't know, $300 for this procedure, why don't we meet in the middle, call it $500. You're getting a discount, I'm getting paid more. And so I think navigating outside of insurance is becoming more and more common because it actually does end up saving the patient money. And I will say candidly, as someone who maxes out our maximum out-of-network pocket deductible because of the chronic illness of my family, I know what it's like to spend $500 to spend 10 minutes with a doctor. I would gladly spend $300 to have 30 minutes of their time without going through insurance. So we're seeing more and more of these outside of the borders of insurance models.
That's interesting. Reminds me of Airbnb. You know, you book someone, the Airbnb, they charge the host and they charge the guest. And if you arrange it off platform, then hopefully they don't kick me off for saying this. If you arrange it off platform, then you can meet in the middle where they're paying less, you're getting more, and, you know, they're cutting out the middleman. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When you're advising someone, so, you know, we've got some physicians that are the sole breadwinner of their family, right? And you've got some who come from two income households. And you've got these two different doctors. They're both considering taking the plunge and going out on their own, starting their own solo practice. How do you advise them both differently? Now, keeping in mind what you told me earlier about, in a lot of those situations, you can just get a similar job to what you had before. And so if the risk doesn't, you know, if you've got this much money in the bank, this is how much you put on an overhead. You know the economics of your family and you can always get a job again, you know, as long as you don't burn any bridges. Keeping that in mind that we already discussed that, you know, how else do you advise these two situations differently?
Yeah. So with any business, you have to figure out how you're going to fund it. And it's not that deep. You either have the money to fund it yourself or you borrow money from someone else, a bank or some other private investors. And so starting your own practice is no different than that. And so looking at your own personal financial situation, let's say you are the sole breadwinner for your family and you don't have a nest egg saved up and you've got to start making money the following Monday when you quit your job, that's a very different scenario than saying, hey, I've got a partner who can financially buffer me and I've got this nest egg and I can self-fund and give myself an on-ramping period. So what most people do is to figure out, you know, what do I need to start this practice? And there's a lot of mindset work around that. Secondly, what is my bridge plan? Do I have enough money to just launch with nothing, no safety net in place? Or do I do something like locums? Or do I go to a part-time model? Or do I, you know, kind of reinvent the scope of my current practice so that I can get this thing up and running? So understanding money is not an optional skill for running a business. So you have to understand what your personal finances are, what it takes to run this business, and having a business model around that. Having an excellent marketing plan so you know how to get people in the door, and then understanding what your risk tolerance is. And some people cannot tolerate risk. They're like, I need to know that I'm making X number of dollars next month. Okay, great. Then let's figure out that problem. Can you do this portfolio career of locums plus, you know, you're doing expert witness stuff? Like, how can you get that money while you're building it? And honestly, some of the happiest physicians I know these days are people who do have those portfolio careers. It's interesting. I have a number of clients who've, I wouldn't call it getting stuck. They actually kind of settled into that middle phase that was meant to be a transitional phase for them. And they said, you know what, actually, it feels great to have a little bit of everything. I didn't realize that I just felt so trapped. So I love having some locums work and being able to serve some patients locally and being able to do this other real estate thing that I was really interested in. They find that they're a lot more fulfilled in their clinical work because it's not their everything. Anyway,
I never heard that term, portfolio career, but I love it. Yeah, and I think that's going to be the answer for a lot of people that have had this, what I've been calling mid-career stagnation, where you look at your four walls and you're like, so this is it for the next 25, 30 years? Like this same thing every day? Like not okay. Yeah.
When I was interviewing right out of residency, when the practice that I ultimately ended up joining, one of the interviewers said to me, we want to hire you and retire you, which, you know, for many people would probably feel great. Hey, it's a job I can have for my entire career. And I knew in that moment, I mean, I was still a resident. I hadn't even started working as an attending. I had this feeling of visceral fear. And I was like, oh my God, that sounds terrible. And I should have known then, but I know now, I was not designed to be that person who's going to be a worker bee for the rest of my life.
I think it was also more common back then, right? Like,
it was.
But like, you know, you would have a parent who worked at the Ford plant and worked on the assembly line from the day they got out of high school to the day that they retired with their gold watch and their pension and whatever.
Yeah,
and that's if you were from a wealthier family, there was a doctor that worked in the hospital and that's what they did until the day that they retired. And the way that our economy is working and our technology is moving, now everything is changing, people just don't do that anymore.
That's correct.
Including us.
If you look at the data for residents, for people who have graduated in the past 5 years, the average length of stay in their first job is 2 years. They join because they're going to make a salary, and they leave because of the administrative work and the culture of leadership. For every doctor who's mid and senior career, who's looking at these younger colleagues who are coming in and saying, oh, these people don't want to work hard, we are missing the boat entirely. These people are very purpose-driven, but they are looking for a very flexible career situation. We can either complain about that, or we can create jobs and systems that allow for people to be able to plug in and then unplug when they need to do that. If you look at women specifically, within 6 years of graduation, 40% of women have already gone part-time or quit medicine. And that is a huge pipeline issue. So we need to create systems that allow people to be able to use their skills and be nimble and be able to transition. This idea that people are going to stay in the same job for 30 years is antiquated. It's simply not going to happen.
And I know that's not the topic, but you mentioned all those people that said that this generation doesn't want to work hard. And it's not my generation. I'm the tail end of Gen X. It's the millennials or Gen Z, the one after them. They don't want to work hard. Are you kidding me? Like, it is so much more competitive for them to get into college, right? Than it was for my generation, than it was for the generation before me. It is so much more competitive to get into medical school, to get into residency, to get into fellowship. They're starting companies. They're published. They're doing so much work. The arms race of scores and clubs and teams and sports and everything. They're working their everything's off in order to get to where we were when, like, your dad might have just walked on to the lacrosse team in college and then applied to medical school to three places and gotten in one of them and went there. Like, no, this generation has worked so much harder before they even get started. That they're like, no, I worked so hard to get here. I have so much going for me. Screw this.
Yes. And they have watched us burn out, get divorced, die by suicide. Like, they want to come and do this work, and they are showing up prepared to do that. So we need to get off our high horses. And I tell my coaching clients, if you're over the age of 40, you need a mentor who is under the age of 35. You need someone who is putting these new ideas into your head so that you can at least see, because this is how we save healthcare, is by not doing it the way it's always been done, because it's not working. That is how we change things. So my kind of retaliation of that is really to be a little countercultural in that way, to be like, yes, I understand that many practices are failing, but that is for practices who are unwilling to change. And if you look at the data for the past 10 years from 2012 to current, yes, of course, there's been this huge shift to be more employed or being bought out by private equity. But the ones that are actually surviving are these small, nimble practices.
I've got to push back on that a little bit and plug my own practice. ENT and Allergy Associates in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, now in Texas. We are over 250 physicians, but we have a clear path to full equity partnership, right? You join the practice, you know what you need to do. You become the same part. I've been with this practice now almost 15 years, and I've been a partner for 10. Like, you become full, equal partners with me. And I think that's a different way to do it. It's a different model. Yes,
I love it.
It's a little more like corporate medicine, but we have an elected board of physicians who are practicing full time. And so they're trying to steer the practice in a way that's good for us, that's good for our patients. There are other models out there too. And I'm a zealot for my practice. I'm a total zealot.
I can tell.
I love it.
I love
my practice. I'm passionate about it. I want to make it better, right? Like, you can love something and want to make it better too.
That's
You know, and working to do so. So if you're an ENT and you're considering it, you know, join a practice. I'm clearly a huge fan, and reach out to me. But I have one more question for you. And that is the analysis paralysis that affects physicians without even starting a podcast. Analysis paralysis that stops us from pulling the trigger. What are some of the things that you see when you've got physicians that are on the fence and they're like overanalyzing it? They just kind of rip the bandaid off and do it. What are the things that hold them back?
Yes, this is my favorite place to coach. This like transitional place from being stuck to recognizing that you have a voice, to like collecting data, to taking action and then launching. It's a very predictable pattern that people go through as they're making any career change, but certainly building a practice. And so I would like to just name it as perfectionism, but it's a little broader than that. This idea of excellence that we are trained with, it is not the same as perfectionism. I can be compassionate, I can work hard, but perfectionism is like, it has to be perfect before I start. Otherwise, I'm going to be paralyzed. I'm going to procrastinate. And if I do anything that's wrong, I'm going to blame myself for that. The entrepreneurial spirit tolerates risk in that way. It tolerates failure in a different way. It looks at it as learning. It looks at it as an opportunity to grow. It looks at it as like, well, that didn't work. Let's get back to the drawing board. And so for any physician who's feeling stuck in their career and they're like, I just need one more certification. I just need to like collect more information. I just need to wait until I'm a little bit more solid and more confident. Confidence is something that is retrospective. You have to do the hard thing in order to become confident. I mean, like anyone who's done any procedure or surgical procedure, like your first one, your hands are shaking because you don't know what you're doing. And then by the time you've done your 100th, you're like, yeah, I've got some rhythm to this. And so building a practice or making career change is the same. So lowering the bar, like we have this idea that it has to be all the bells and whistles in place and all everything's figured out. We've got all the systems working before we launch and have our first patient in the door. So like, how do you break that cycle down into something smaller and smaller and smaller till it just feels like something that you could just like put in a drawer? Meaning, if I'm going to build a practice, the smallest bite of a practice is like, I need to schedule a call with my mentor, or yeah, I need to Google EMRs, or I need to look into my financial statement and figure out how much money I need to do this. What is the smallest tiny thing?
What is the bare minimum?
Yes.
I need to start a practice. And you start with that. It's funny. That's what we tell to people who are starting a podcast. Right. What do I need? Oh, I need a mic. Then get a mic. Which mic? Doesn't matter. Recording. Yes. Just get something. It doesn't matter because it's going to suck at the beginning. And then you figure out what's important to you and you build from there. So what is the bare minimum that you need to start a practice? And then you go from there.
That's exactly right. It's the smallest thing. So for me, as an N of one in a micro practice, I have one exam room and it has everything I need in there. But did it have every tool that I have now when I open the doors? No, it didn't. Like I wasn't doing pap smears, but like now I'm drawing my own blood. And now I do my own EKGs because remember, I have an hour of patients, so I can spend an hour for one. Like, I didn't want to hire someone to come in and do that. So the patients love it. And I got to add those services as I went on. And then as I realized, man, you know what? I need someone to answer the phone now. I just hired someone to start answering the phone. So like there's ways to say over time, in order for me to open the doors, what I need is my brain and a pen and pencil. Yeah. That's literally it. That you can open a practice tomorrow with that. There's ways to do that in a more sophisticated way and we'll have more patients on your mailing list and all that. But what is the smallest tiny bite and then building from there? Yeah. It doesn't have to be the finished product, right? It's just like medicine. We learn a little bit every day and we get a little bit better every day. Yeah.
You have a 24.
Or I don't.
Reflex hammer?
I actually don't. I have my stethoscope. I use that as a reflex hammer to suck out. Don't tell the neurologist.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing. Amazing. Well, Dr. Kara Pepper, thank you so much for your time. So for those who are interested, her podcast is It's Not Just You. It's a fantastic podcast about starting your own practice. And you also the founder of Micro Practice Mastermind, a community for physicians transforming healthcare through solo practice. So where can people find you online if they're interested in learning more?
Yeah, if you can remember my name, you can find me. It's Kara with a K, Kara Pepper. MD is my handle on all social media. My website is carapeppermd.com. If you need to find me, my email is hello@carapeppermd.com. So just Google me, you'll find me.
Amazing. Well, Dr. Pepper, thank you so much for your time and all you do for your patients and to keep the practice of medicine alive.
Thank you. It is so fun.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it or comment on a social media post or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you. This is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.